Kia ora, tēnā koto katoa. Welcome to Emirates Podcast, episode 351. Today is Sunday, March 28, 2021. This is the 14th anniversary of the Emirates Podcast. Coincidentally, the last episode I released was the 13th episode of the Emirates Podcast, exactly 1 year ago today. Things happened, as they do, and of course 2020 wasn't a normal year for anyone, and I'm no different in that respect, and a lot of the same issues were at play with me as they were for most people. But I thought I would start today by talking about what I've been doing over the past year, because I know one or two people might be interested in knowing. And so the first thing is the most obvious, and that's that 1 year ago today, we were under lockdown here in New Zealand. And that essentially, it was level 4 lockdown, which is the most severe. And that meant that we couldn't go anywhere except to exercise in our neighborhood, to the supermarket, to the doctor, to the chemist, actually to the petrol station as well. But other than that, we weren't allowed to be around anybody who wasn't in our household already. And we had to keep at least 2 meters distance to anybody from anybody we met out on the street, say walking, going for a walk. We ran into anybody, we had to keep at least 2 meters from us and them. And that went on for 5 weeks, as it turned out. I didn't know that at the time I recorded, obviously, but it did. And then we went to level 3, which was a bit lighter than that. At the time I called it lockdown light, because we still couldn't get together with other people, except we were allowed to have an expanded bubble, which meant that we could form a new bubble with somebody from a different household as long as the two were mutually exclusive with each other. Now, in my case, I formed an extended bubble with my cousin-in-law because we both live alone, and it was easier. Well, it's not just that it was easier, but also everyone else that we knew already had bubbles with their household members, in some cases, people who weren't living with them. So we couldn't expand beyond just the two of us, which is fine. I also did a click-and-collect shopping thing at one point. I needed some supplies from the home center to finish some projects around the house because I hadn't gotten enough before lockdown. And that was a kind of surreal experience because I've never done that before. I ordered it online and they sent me a notification that I could go pick it up. And I went and they scanned a barcode and loaded it in the back of my car and I was away. And that was it. And I only did that once. But you could also, like, say, get a cup of coffee in a similar way and go through a fast food drive-through, but you couldn't go inside a restaurant or cafe or a bar or anything like that. Then we went to level 2, and that was nearer normal anyway. We could go to restaurants and cafes and bars again, but there had to be table service, and we had to remain at least 2 meters away from anybody else. And we were also supposed to keep 2 meters distance from people in the supermarket and elsewhere, any other shop we went into. Then after that, we went to level 1, which is as close to normal as you can get. Basically, it is normal. We can get together with as many people as we want. We can, what else? We can go to bars, restaurants, cafes, sports stadiums. We've had full sports stadiums, concerts, fairs, parades, all of that sort of stuff. It's basically as normal as you can get without it officially being normal. And there aren't that many differences, really. The only real difference that I can think of off the top of my head is that we're required to use a special app, a COVID tracer app, to scan QR codes in every business we enter. And also, if we don't have a smartphone or don't want to use it, then we have to write down in a ledger, kind of like a guest book, for every business we visit. And the point of that is that if there is a community outbreak, they can trace people who were potentially in contact much faster and hopefully get the outbreak contained much more quickly. It's worked very well so far. We've had 2 community outbreaks since lockdown, one in August of last year and one in February of this year. And in both cases, it did require going up levels. Both of them were in Auckland, and they went back to level 3. And the rest of New Zealand went to level 2. And they couldn't, no one could enter or leave Auckland when it was at level 3. And that was enforced by the police and the army. And they had some trouble, but I mean, the border was actually a lot more fluid than that sounds. More people were able to get through than you would think. But it was still basically like a level 4 lockdown, just with a little bit more leeway. And most of the time since we started going up levels again, or down levels is the word, last year. We've been at level one most of the time. And the thing is that the both of those outbreaks are somehow connected to the border. We don't know exactly how. They never did figure it out. But the reason that's an issue is because that is our vulnerable point. Right now, the only people allowed in New Zealand are citizens and permanent residents, and certain other people who have special permission to enter. Could be on compassionate grounds, but more likely it's somebody who's considered an essential worker, like all the people working on the Avatar movies, the people who were here for the America's Cup yacht racing, that sort of thing. But also, interestingly enough, fruit pickers, because they can't get enough here in New Zealand. But everybody who enters, regardless of why or how, has to go through managed isolation. It's in a hotel, and the meals are provided and all that. It lasts 2 weeks. The people are supposed to get a test. Originally, it was on day 3 and day 12, I think it was. Although nowadays, they do it on day 0 as well. And they have to test negative on the second one. Well, ideally, well, it would have to be both of them, I guess, because if they tested positive on either the first two, they'd be sent to actual quarantine where there's actual medical staff. But if they test negative on the first two and then on day 12, then they would be released on day 14, because 14 days is considered more than enough to ensure that somebody isn't infectious. And so most people have done that without any problem. Every once in a while, there'll be somebody who will refuse to take the test. And when that happens, they're required to stay an extra 14 days in managed isolation. And I think they have to pay for the additional 14 days. They have to pay for the first 14, but I think they have to pay for the second 14 as well. So there's a clear financial incentive to comply and take the tests. And all of the cases that we've had have been connected to the border somehow, even though those two community cases, although the specific link was never identified, at least not yet. And so that's our greatest vulnerability, which is important now because Australia and New Zealand are talking about opening what they're calling a trans-Tasman bubble, which will allow residents of the two countries to travel to the other without quarantine. And that has huge risk for both countries, because if there's an outbreak in one, it could spread to the other through these unquarantined people. And so, I don't know, because the thing about that is that if you go to the other country and there's an outbreak and the border is closed, you could get stuck in the other country for weeks, potentially, depending on how severe the outbreak is. And you'd be responsible for looking after yourself because there ain't no such thing as travel insurance for an occasion like that. And so it's really risky. It's too risky for me. I wouldn't be willing to do it. But I do think that it won't happen until later this year after there are significant percentages of the two countries that are vaccinated. And the vaccine program is just starting here. They've vaccinated the border staff, the customs workers and so on, and also people working in MIQ facilities, and they've moved on to vaccinating their family and close contacts, which is a very smart thing to do. And the next group will be elderly people, and also people who live in South Auckland, because both of the community outbreaks that have happened so far have been in South Auckland. And so they want to try to prevent that from happening in the future. Part of the main reason for that is Auckland International Airport is in South Auckland. And so a lot of the airport workers and border people live in South Auckland, and so, or who come in contact with border workers live in South Auckland. So they want to try to contain that, really. And South Auckland also has a high level of poverty and bad health outcomes as it is. So by vaccinating them first, they hope to be able to prevent any more outbreaks in that part of New Zealand. I should be able to get mine in May, because in May they start with people who are higher risk, other than elderly. And in my case, it's hypertension and also my coronary artery disease. And then in June, I believe it is, they will start with the general population. The government has ordered enough vaccines for every man, woman, and child in New Zealand, and plus a whole bunch more, because they plan on sharing with the Pacific Islands near us, and as part of their commitment to the Pacific. And all of us will be getting the Pfizer vaccine, because the government, well, it's the most, still the most effective, but the main reason is because it simplifies the logistics for the government in getting the vaccines out and tracking who's had it and when they need to get the next one and all those sorts of things. So part of it is just simply a logistical thing, but I'm quite happy with that result. And as I said, I expect to get mine in May, but we'll see. And I'll probably talk about that as when I actually know something. So COVID has been for me, as it was for everyone else, probably the biggest thing that happened over the past year. I found the 5 weeks of lockdown difficult because I was by myself, except for the fur babies. And thank goodness I had my fur babies because they kept me from really losing it. The main problem I had is that I was too scared to go to the supermarket. And I couldn't order groceries in because the supermarket chain I use, I presume the other one as well, set aside all of their delivery slots for vulnerable people, especially the elderly, but also people with health conditions, and they had to register with the supermarket to be able to do that. At the time, it was overwhelming, and I just couldn't get my head around it, so I didn't even try. But I also thought to myself that there were probably people who needed it far more than I did, because my pantry and freezer were already well filled, so I had lots of stuff. And family did drop by a couple small things I had run out of during that time. They would drop at the door, ring the doorbell, and then go back down toward the footpath about 3 or 4 meters away. We'd have a quick visit, and then they would head back home. So I did have some human contact during those 5 weeks. And eventually I found a company I was able to order from, and I got in some supplies, and that tided me over until things opened up again. But it was difficult being by myself. And that's actually been a recurring theme over the past year, because there's a lot of things I've had to go through alone, and I find that challenging, as I suppose anybody would. First and foremost, I had health adventures, not challenges so much. I was waiting for a procedure. I think I talked about this before. And it's called cryoablation. What they do is they put a probe in through the artery in your leg and they snake it up to your heart, and then they freeze the cryo, the nerve areas that are sending the rogue signals to your heart, because what I was happening with my atrial fibrillation is that the top and bottom parts of the heart were beating differently. It's the signals are supposed to come from the bottom, and they were coming from the top. So the procedure seemed to be a success. So give you the end of the story first. I haven't felt any unusual rhythms that I'm aware of. Just before lockdown, I bought a device to allow me to do the equivalent of a 6-lead ECG. And every time I've used it, it's come out completely normal. And even when I've felt a little bit unwell, it's been completely normal, which is, of course, a very good thing. But going through it was difficult all the same. What got everything moving is that I went to see a cardiologist privately. I paid for the appointment. And my sister-in-law went with me, which is something that Nigel would have done, of course. But she's a nurse, and so I thought she was actually a really good choice. And the cardiologist put me on new medication because I've been tired all the time ever since this whole nightmare began. And I felt that it was one of the drugs I was on that was pulling me back down, because it was a drug that was intended to control my heart rhythm, and it did, but it did it by slowing down my heart rate, and that made me tired all the time. So he changed it to a drug I'd been on before, actually, and I was really nervous about changing drugs because I thought, you know, if something goes wrong, I have to deal with this all by myself. Whereas Nigel would have been there, he would have looked after me, he would have taken me to the doctor if he thought I needed to go to the doctor, all those sorts of things. As it happens, I did have a bad reaction to the drug, but I coped with it, and I arranged to go back on my original drug. So that was sorted in the end. But then when I had the procedure, which is beginning of December, I had to go through that essentially alone as well. Now, my brother-in-law took me to the hospital. One of my sisters-in-law came in to pick me up and had to stay for a while because, you know, these things always take more time than you think. And then another sister-in-law came and stayed at my house that night because the doctors wanted somebody to stay at my house, as they would, you know, anybody who goes through the procedure. They want somebody to stay with them that first night. So the family was absolutely 100% there for me, and they helped me get through that. But it's just not the same. Nigel would have been with me every step of the way. He would have stayed at the hospital with me all day long. And he would have been my rock, as he always had been. And so I was keenly aware of that, especially during the middle of the day when I was there all by myself. And also after the procedure, I had to lie flat on my back for 4 hours. And I don't ever lie flat on my back, certainly not for 4 hours. And all of a sudden, my back started seizing up. Cramping up, I suppose, is a better way of putting it. And I started to get to a point where I was in utter agony. And it was so bad, in fact, that I thought to myself, I wish I'd never done it. But I was also keenly aware that if Nigel was there, he would have talked me off the ledge and he would have helped me feel better emotionally, at least, if not physically. And that was probably the point where I missed him the most. But I got through it, and I'm supposed to see them, well, it's anywhere from 5 to 6 months, no, 4 to 6 months after the procedure, to review my medications to see what they're going to change and so on. And I'm hoping that they change the one that I think is making me tired, although there's also the fear that it may not be that at all and nothing will improve. But first things first, let's get to the review. But that procedure seemed to go well, and I made it through that. And I made it through it the same way I always do, which is to just do it, to borrow a phrase. I don't really have a whole lot of options, and the best one I've come up with is to stay busy as much as I can, but also to focus on where I'm trying to get to so that I can deal a bit better with the challenges, emotional, physical, and so on, that I might face at any given point. And so far, that's worked pretty well. So far, I've been able to get past any difficult times by focusing on moving forward. And when I do have a bad patch, and I still do, I just realize that that's part of the process, and I just breathe and wait for it to pass, because it always does. You know, I don't spend my days curled up in a ball in the corner sobbing my eyes out. Whatever sad time I have, crying fits, whatever, they always pass. They always do. And I know that. So if I do have a bad patch, I just write it out. And I try to focus on projects, things around the house, and so on, to try to keep everything and keep me moving forward. And that also has helped a lot over the past year. I haven't finished emptying the garage yet. It was one of Nigel's big regrets that he didn't get a chance to, as he said, get rid of all his toys before he died. But I don't think he would have been able to do it anyway, even if he hadn't died so quickly, because it would have meant that he would have been getting cancer treatment and he wouldn't have felt up to it. So either way, I was going to end up having to deal with it all anyway. So, you know, I'm perfectly relaxed about all that. And I am about a garage full of boxes, because I'll get to it when I get to it. Early on in this process, I developed a slogan that I used, which is that it was what I can, when I can. And I still live by that. I don't try to push myself or force myself to do something, because it only sets myself up for disappointment or whatever, or a meltdown. It's better that I do what I can, when I can, and when I can't, I don't. And as far as I'm concerned, if it takes me a year longer to get through the garage, it takes me a year longer to get through the garage. I don't really care. I would like to get my office and bedroom sorted, because there's stuff in my office that just has nowhere to go, and I need to get all that sorted. But I've been pulled in a million different directions over the past year. And one of those was because Nigel and I had a storage unit up not far from our last house. We got it in the end of 2018, and it was partly to declutter. He wanted to use our garage as a workshop, and we needed to get stuff out of there. So we did that, and then when he died, of course, it was still sitting there, largely empty. But it ended up being a good thing, because there were some things that didn't go with the movers that I needed to put somewhere when I sold the house. And so I used the storage unit to put them in. And again, I didn't fill it up. It just had more stuff in it, is all. And then over the next few months, I took what I could, after lockdown I'm talking about, because that happened right after I sold the house. And so I went up there a few times and took stuff out and brought it back in my car. And then last Sunday, a week ago today, my brother-in-law and I went up to the storage unit in his car, because it's bigger than mine, so we could get the last of the bits and pieces. There were some things that were too big for my car, but the main problem is there were a few things that were too heavy for me to lift by myself. And so I needed him to help me, or somebody. And he was available, and so he helped me do that. And now the storage unit is empty. I've turned in the key card, and that's gone. That's one more thing off my plate, one less thing I have to think about. And that's also significant because it was the last physical thing tying me to the last house that Nigel and I shared. And it's not a particularly emotional thing as such, but it was nevertheless binding me to everything that happened. And not all of that was good, obviously. I mean, we had some good times at that house, but the way it ended was not good. And having that storage unit just kept me tethered to all of that. So getting rid of it was good for that alone. But the main thing is, it meant that that was off my plate. I could just concentrate on what was at my house because everything I had was here. And I could focus on that alone and not think, oh, geez, I've got that stuff in the storage unit I need to get. I mean, for weeks or months, it was that, oh, there's shelves in there. I really want to get those shelves so that I can set them up in my garage so I've got somewhere to put things. But I couldn't make it to the garage because the COVID levels kept changing. And every time Auckland went to level 3, I couldn't go up there to get anything out of the storage unit. And then even when they went back to level 2, there's this little period where you're thinking to yourself, or I'm thinking to myself, I wonder if there's still some outbreak they haven't quite found yet. And I didn't really want to go up there in case that was the case. So there was a lot of that going on over the past year as well, or past 6 months anyway. And I eventually, obviously, I whittled away at it when I could, when the levels permitted. And now that's off my plate, done, dusted. And I can, as I said, concentrate only on what's in this house. But there was one other thing that happened this year where I keenly missed Nigel, and that was that I lost Sunny. She'd gotten sick, early-ish part of the year, middle-ish part of the year last year. And I took her to the vet. She stopped eating, and I took her to the vet, and the vet determined that she had a rotten tooth and others that needed to come out as well. I was really leery about this because she just turned 12, I guess it was. 11 or 12, I've forgotten now. I'd have to look it up. I could never remember their ages. Anyway, so I was really reluctant because older dogs don't handle anesthetic very well. They did the test. They said she'd be fine. And so I said, oh, okay. Well, it wasn't that cavalier. It was more like, okay. And so they did the procedure, and she was never right again after that. She developed inflammatory bowel disease, which, not to get too elaborate, but basically it would leave her to have very unpleasant and messy emissions. Now, at first, they happen a lot in the house, and because I don't have a dog door or anything, so she couldn't get out unless I let her out, and sometimes she just didn't know it was going to happen until it did. But over time, we got a rhythm down so that she would run over to the door and I could go over there and open it up for her and she could go outside and do her business. But when she had a particularly bad attack, she would have to go out several times in a row every few minutes, every couple minutes. And the only way I could stop it was by giving her a steroid. When, of course, steroids long-term are not a good thing for anyone. But the main thing is I knew that this was a closed-ended deal, that she wasn't ever going to recover from this. I hoped for a long time she would, that she'd get better, but she just never did. And she continued to get thinner and thinner and thinner until she was what I just called fur and bones. And I don't know if the specific cause was it or not, but the vet also identified she had a mitral heart valve problem. And ultimately, that's probably what did her in. And so finally, last month, I guess it was, she let me know it was time. And I took her on the final car ride to the vet, as any good daddy would do. And my brother-in-law and sister-in-law went with me. And we also then had fish and chips afterwards so they could keep me company for a little while. But it had been a very difficult time for me because I was always worried about her and I was always watching her to see how her behavior was. I didn't sleep well because in case she needed to go out to the toilet in the middle of the night and I'd have to get up and let her out. And so I was always keeping an ear open, pretty much. And it was very stressful and very taxing on me as well as her. And I went away with the family to Queenstown in November. And our niece stayed here at the house with the dogs and looked after them. And that was fine. It worked out. But I realized she was off for a few days afterwards. And I realized that I wouldn't be able to leave her with anybody, certainly not anybody who wasn't family, but I probably wouldn't be able to leave her with anyone. So that weighed on me as well, because I knew that I couldn't go anywhere. And so in the end, things went along for several weeks, months. There were several times I thought she was on her way out. We had a birthday party for Nigel in August of last year, because I wanted the family to have something positive to focus on rather than the horrible anniversary only a few weeks later. But she, on that very day, I had to take her to the vet because she was so sick, but she came right. And then I thought, oh, she's not going to make it to the first anniversary of Nigel dying, but she made it past that. She made it through Christmas. She made it through my birthday. And she was a trooper in a sense. She wasn't ready to go until she was ready to go. And I was determined I was going to give her every chance to come right if she could. And I was going to be her advocate and her ally, and she would let me know when it was time, and she did. So I brought her ashes and collar home, put them on the dresser next to Nigel's. Nigel's ashes, not his collar. He didn't have one, oddly enough. Maybe he should have. But I put them up there, and then every once in a while, Leo would walk over and put his nose up in the air, sniffing in the air and whimpering. So I'd pick up Sonny's collar and let him sniff it, and then he was fine. So it stayed there for quite some time. And then I thought, well, this isn't working. So I took the collar and I hung it on a drawer knob for that dresser. And then he would be able to sniff it whenever he wanted. And he did. And he was fine. But I've noticed lately that every morning when he gets up, the first thing he does is he walks over and sniffs the collar. He doesn't seem even remotely sad. He doesn't seem lost. He doesn't seem despondent, any of that stuff. It just seems to be a little reassurance he does. It's as if he's saying good morning to Sonny every day, although I don't think that that's what's really going on. I don't know what it is, if it's just, oh, I recognize that smell kind of thing. It could be simple as that, or it could be something emotional, because dogs have more emotion than humans often give them credit for. But when I did that, I originally thought it'd just be for like maybe a week, and then he wouldn't need it anymore, but it's kept going. So I'm going to leave it there until he stops sniffing it. And then I'll eventually put it in a bag with her ashes, probably, because I'm not going to keep them out forever. I never do. And although her ashes are eventually going to go with me when my time comes, all of the previous fur babies went with Nigel. So they're all of the ashes of everyone I've loved in New Zealand is still in the house. Our little family is still together in a way. And I think about that from time to time. But that was the most recent big challenge. That it was a very sad time, but it was also a bit of a relief because the stress and strain was off of me. I still haven't really gotten back to anything approaching the normal I had before she got sick, but then nothing about this past year has been normal for anyone, so that's not really a surprise, I don't think. Right now, I'm still doing stuff around the house. I just had this solar tube installed in the kitchen to bring daylight into the kitchen because it doesn't have any natural light of its own, no windows or anything. It's in the middle of the house. And I've got other projects that are on the boil, and I bought a new sofa, and I've gotten rid of other furniture. You know, all the sorts of things that some people might think are exciting about building a new home, but they're not for me because Nigel's not here, and we used to share this sort of stuff. We used to talk about sort of stuff. He usually got his way, and I didn't get mine more often than not. But it's just not fun. It's stuff I have to do, and don't get me wrong, I like what I'm doing, and I'm satisfied with stuff once I finally decide what I'm going to do, and that sometimes takes a while. But it's not fun. And that is the whole reality of where I'm at right now. It's been a year of turbulence. It's been a year of some sorrow. It's not been fun, and I wouldn't say I'm in a place where I'm happy, but I'm in a place where I'm okay. And sometimes okay is good enough. So that's what I've been up to over the past year, and that's what I have not talked about since I haven't recorded. I should add that there was a period in there where I didn't have a computer I could record with for a variety of reasons, which I'm not going to bother going into now. But I've since gotten a new Mac Mini, one of the M1 Mac Minis, which I know Paul would be very glad to hear. And so things are back in order now, back running again. And I can record again. I'd said a long time ago that I would never just stop, that I would say something if I was to quit podcasting. And even if it only was an announcement on the Emrin's website, emrinspodcast.com website, there would be some sort of notification that I was stopping. I wouldn't just disappear. So keep that in mind as well in case there's another long gap. It doesn't mean that I've completely gone away. It just means that I'm busy with other things or similar. But I am better overall. I'll leave you with this. Overall, I'm better than I was last year at this time for a whole bunch of reasons. And I keep moving forward all the time whenever I can. What I can, when I can. And this particular podcast episode is one of those things. So, that's it for today. I hope to talk to you again soon. Kakete ano. Bye. You can comment on this or any episode of the Emrin's Podcast at emrinspodcast.com, where you can also leave a voice message. You can visit and comment on the Emrin's Facebook page, or you can email me, with or without a voice message, at emrins@gmail.com. This podcast is a proud member of the Pride 48 Network and is produced and distributed under Creative Commons license. Complete details at the website,